Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, we'll discuss Jerry Brown's legacy as the longest-serving governor of California. Brown left office today amidst accolades for proving that California is actually governable and leaving the state stronger than he found it in 2011. His illustrious political career includes two-term stints as governor, separated by nearly 30 years, mayor of Oakland and state attorney general. Gavin Newsom, the former lieutenant governor and mayor of San Francisco, was sworn in as California's 40th governor today. He will inherit a $29 billion budget reserve, the fifth largest economy in the world, and a leadership position on the global climate change stage. But many of California's problems remain, including a severe housing shortage, the highest poverty rate in the U.S., marked income inequality, and billions of dollars in unfunded public pensions. Tonight, we'll ask what will be remembered as Jerry Brown's biggest accomplishments and shortcomings, and what's on Gavin Newsom's plate for 2019. Joining me here in the studio to discuss these issues is Narda Zacchino. She's an author of many books, including California Comeback, The Genius of Jerry Brown, and an award-winning journalist. During her 31 years at the LA Times, she served as associate editor and Sacramento bureau chief during Jerry Brown's second term as governor. Welcome, Narda Zacchino.
Thank you, Joseph.
And by phone, we're joined by two guests. The first is Annie Nodoff, the Director of California Advocacy at the National Resources Defense Council, a nonprofit international environmental advocacy group. Welcome, Annie Nodoff.
Yeah, thanks. Great to be here.
And finally, we're joined by Dan Walters, author and longtime California political journalist. He arrived in Sacramento at the same time as Jerry Brown in 1975 and has been following Brown's career ever since. In addition to writing for multiple other publications, Dan spent 33 years reporting at the Sacramento Bee and currently is a columnist at Cal Matters and the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome, Dan Walters.
Thank you.
And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. I'll give you that phone number now. It's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. So I wanted to ask each of you in turn, just to get a sense of where you stand on the Brown legacy question, what would you say stands out for you as either qualities of achievements or shortcomings of the governor? Let's start with you, Narda Zacchino, in the studio.
Okay. I would say that his greatest achievement has been in climate change action, and just in really getting the state on a stable ground financially. I think his advocacy for a tax increase came at the right time. He worked very hard. He's worked hard for the last three tax increases, and that have really put California on a sound footing. I think those two things. Also, education is another area in which he made some inroads. And in terms of equalizing funding for and giving more money to schools with low-income students, which was a smart thing to do.
Anything you want to point out as a shortcoming or something that he didn't quite get done that he would have hoped?
Yeah, he didn't get his twin tunnels to the south done, and he didn't get the bullet train done. And Gavin Newsom has said, I guess we'll get to what he wants to do, but he did say he will continue building those things, but not as ambitiously, let's say, as the governor.
All right. So let's go to you next, Annie Nodoff. The first thing Narda said was Governor Brown's work on climate change. What do you say about that as part of the National Resources Defense Council?
Yeah, thank you. I've been very involved in getting California to, you know, step up to lead on climate since the Davis administration, actually, and then Governor Schwarzenegger picked that up, and then certainly Governor Brown doubled down even further. I think one of the things that distinguished Brown's involvement in climate action is that he really saw that as big as California is, California cannot solve climate change alone. And so he and his staff worked together to forge international agreements with states and provinces and cities and businesses around the world to work together on climate and forge an alliance, which really had a lot of meaning on the global stage, and we can talk more about that later. I think he also was actually in the environmental field. He had some very strong pro-wildlife actions. He also had good public health policies that he signed into law. I'd say that we at NRDC disagreed with his giant tunnel proposals and have made alternative proposals for a more modest transfer facility, and also just getting local governments and local water districts to develop local supplies. And I think he made some progress on that, and getting drought as a way of life in terms of water conservation around the state. And I think we can talk more about Governor Newsom now, but I think he does have a more integrated vision for water management, and without such a focus on the tunnels.
Okay. And Dan Walters, what do you think of this list of accomplishments and some not-so accomplishments that have been listed by NARDA and Annie?
Well, I think it's correct to say he has been a leader in the climate change issue. I would take issue, I guess, with the idea that he's fixed California's finances. In fact, he doesn't say he has a legacy. He rejects the whole idea of legacy. And so I think we have to take that into account as well. But yes, he did balance an imbalanced budget, but we have to put that in context. And the context was that he is the only governor of recent memory to have a steadily expanding economy. And he would not claim credit for that. It's just something that happened to happen on his watch. Had the recession continued on through his governorship, we might be talking about an entirely different thing. So the combination of an expanding economy, yes, the tax increase that he got the voters to approve, although that wasn't as big a part of it as one might think. And finally, he's been relatively tight with a buck. At least he's been very suspicious of making high-dollar, long-term commitments. All of those had the effect of certainly closing the budget deficit he inherited, and number two, creating a rainy day fund against a future recession. However, there's a caveat, and the caveat is that he, by raising those taxes on high-income Californians, he made the state budget even more dependent on a handful of taxpayers, the one percenters who provide half of the state income taxes, and therefore about a third of the entire state budget comes from 1% of taxpayers. And that's a very dangerous and volatile thing, and it's gotten worse under his watch because of that tax increase. Secondly, the rainy day fund that he created would be about less than a third of what the state would lose in revenue over 3 years if we did have a recession. So it's not a guarantee against cutbacks. So in a way, the budget situation in California is in some respects more precarious now than when he took office 8 years ago. And so I think you have to put that in that context, so that if we do get a recession, which is almost certain we're going to have one sometime during Gavin Newsom's governorship, the effects of that could be even worse than they were the last time around.
I'd like to just take issue with that a little bit. he inherited a $27 billion deficit in 2010. The economy wasn't in great shape. It wasn't improving like it is today. Today he has a surplus of $15 billion, or the state does, and $14.5 billion rainy day fund, as you mentioned, and the taxes are supposed to bring in another estimated $8 billion this fiscal year, with more than 3 million new jobs created. Now, it's true that the economy improved everywhere, but I know, and you might recall, of course, Dan, in 2010, all Jerry Brown wanted to do is to get the legislature to go to the taxpayers and get some fees extended that they had been paying since 2009, and he couldn't even get, you know, two or three Republican votes. He needed to put a measure before the voters and let them vote on it, and that's when he came up with Proposition 30. It took him 2 years. He got the measure on the ballot. He used his political skills to do so, and that was attributable to him. So I think in that sense, you know, whether the economy had much to do with it then or now or whatever, and yes, I agree with you, it's a precarious situation, but I think he deserves credit for what he did in 2010 when he couldn't get even the most democratic thing we can do in this country is have people vote on something. He couldn't even put those fee extensions before the voters.
Well, he's fully entitled to credit for what he did. I'm mm-hmm. just saying that he did not take on the sort of tax reform that Gavin Newsom says is necessary, and almost mm-hmm. every financial authority says is absolutely necessary if California is to have a truly stable budget. He refused to do that, specifically refused to do that, said it was a heavy lift and he wasn't willing to make the lift. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, as he leaves office, the state is more dependent on a very small base of taxpayers.
True.
And therefore the budget is even... the revenue system is even more volatile, potentially volatile, than it was when he took office, and therefore the next recession could have an even worse effect than it did the last time around.
Okay.
So we're reaching some consensus here.
I think
that.
So, yeah. Okay. I wouldn't disagree with that.
Okay. Well, it sounds like for now we're in better financial shape than when he came into office, although it's on shaky ground, as been conceded by Norda here. So before we get into a lot more of the what he accomplished, what he didn't, let's spend a little time just understanding how he got to where he is, and not to spend a lot of time on that, but I think something about his life history and his trajectory mm-hmm. kind of can maybe help us understand some of the choices he's made over time. Nardit, how do you conceive of Jerry Brown as a politician, as a person, if
right.
you wanted to sum it up for listeners?
Well, first of all, I think he's one of our most interesting politicians that we've had. I remember he came to my house once in Sacramento as Dick Magian was coming into office, and he started walking out the door, and he turned around and he said, "You people in the press corps are going to be really bored when I leave." And I think Dan might even agree with that. But when I think back at the beginning of Jerry Brown when he became governor. Now, forget that he was Secretary of State and pushed through the Political Reform Act. He was one of the first people in a public office. Tom Bradley, mayor of Los Angeles, was another. But when Jerry Brown came in, he appointed women and people of color for the first time to commissions and agencies and his cabinet and his staff and on the Supreme Court and regents of the university. That was like to me as a woman, it was a revolutionary thing he did. And after Jerry Brown, that continued.
So you're saying that even in his first term as two terms as governor.
Exactly, even in his first two terms. And, he got the Political Reform Act. He pushed that in 1974, coming out of the Secretary of State's office, the Agricultural Labor Relations Act to give rights of labor to farm workers. That was also in his first term. In his second term, he had Proposition 13 to deal with. And there's a whole lot to say about that. We don't have time for. And then, in his third and fourth terms, he dealt with the taxes. And I think, what always struck me about him was that he was totally a fiscal conservative and a social liberal. And I remember, I think it was when he was elected to his third term, he vetoed the Democrat. He had a majority Democratic legislature, and he vetoed the budget because he said it was too fat. So he was always conscious about spending the state's money. And I hope Gavin Newsom can hold back the Democrats in the legislature, because now they have a supermajority, and I think he's going to have to be firm.
Hmm. So, Dan Walter, back to you. Is that a fair way?
Yeah, he was very conscientious about widening the scope of people appointed to the administrative positions and the bench, and he ever up to his virtually his last day in office just this week, he was still doing the same thing. And he deserves all the credit in the world. Now, having said that, there's always another side to it, right?
That's right.
By appointing Rose Byrd as Chief Justice rather than as an Associate Justice, while it was a great symbolic act on his part, it backfired badly when she and two other justices were thrown off the Supreme Court and allowed George Dick Magian to appoint a very conservative court followed by Pete Wilson. So it was a symbolic gesture, maybe very sincere, but it also backfired. And you see that in a lot of things that Jerry Brown did, particularly during his first governorship. For example, as Narda mentioned, he got the Farm Labor Act passed, creating the Agricultural Labor Relations Board, with the idea that it would help the United Farm Workers Union finally achieve some success in organizing farm workers. It turned out, however, that the Farm Workers Union is no better off today than it was 40-plus years ago. It didn't ever really do what was intended to be done. It was a gesture, but it didn't really make any long-standing difference in the outcome. And I think you have to say that about a lot of the things he did, both in his first stint and his second stint. They kind of had their novel ideas, certainly changing the policy apparatus or the policy gestalt. But did they really work out in the long run? Narda mentioned changing school finance, putting more money into school districts with large numbers of poor and English learner students, with the idea to close the achievement gap between them and their more privileged classmates. Well, it hasn't worked, at least not yet. There has been no appreciable change in that. So you have to say, is that a good thing to do? Well, we won't know until long years later whether it actually works or not. Right now, so far, it's not having any effect on the presumed goal of closing that achievement gap.
And what? So you're saying he's visionary in doing things differently or trying to improve on things that have been problematic for a long time. But even these shifts in approach haven't yet delivered. Is it a matter of time? Is it a matter of something else that was falling short in the way he planned, the people around him who advised him? What would you point to as potential factors in why some of these innovations didn't quite pan out?
Well, I was going to say, this is Annie Nodoff, the story about the appointment of the Supreme Court justices in his first terms in office actually, I think, helped inform how he approached governing in the second, in his second time around. And that is, that kind of led to the paddle to the left, paddle to the right approach that he often talks, because what he tried to do with the appointment of Rose Byrd and Cruz Reynoso earlier was to really make a huge statement on death penalty reform, but that was too much too fast for the people of California, and it ended up putting back the cause of death penalty reform for decades. And that's a very cautionary tale that he learned from and tried to incorporate how fast he can push and when the timing's right. I think the second time around, he and his chief staff person, Nancy McFadden, were very attuned to identifying when is the right time, when are the forces coming together that we can push something forward, whether it's the extension of the state's cap and trade program, whether it's the gas tax and those kind of things. They would look for the convergence of interests and see a path forward to move. And so I think that some of those early experiences really did inform the way he governed later on.
So I would agree with that. It's Jerry Brown in his second incarnation was a much more cautious politician, a much more conventional politician, and a much more cautious politician. He was willing to do what he could do, but he was not as willing as he was the first time around in taking chances on things. And he was therefore willing to settle, in many cases, for kind of half a loaf. A good example being pension reform. He did a small pension reform, said we need to do more, but never actually proposed to do more. He said that reforming CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, was, quote, the Lord's work, but he never would actually do it. He was kind of an agnostic in doing the Lord's work. So he was a very cautious politician. I think this is just surmise on my part, he really wanted to establish a legacy, something that would offset the kind of flaky Governor Moonbeam image that he acquired the first time around. And therefore, he only wanted to do what he could do, things he could check off of his bucket list, but he didn't want to take on very difficult things, extremely difficult things, like tax reform or CEQA reform, that would have cost a lot of political capital and for which there was no guarantee of success.
So, Nader, I know you want to get in here. I was just going to frame it, your comments this way. He went from perhaps disruptor in the first two terms to incrementalist and a little bit more gun-shy, shall I say. Was that simply because of the experience of becoming more experienced as a politician over time, or are there other factors that you think kind of led him to shift his approach in the second two terms as governor?
Well, I think he became much more of a pragmatist. I think in the first term, you know, he was very quirky and weird in a lot of ways. I mean, it wasn't just Rose Byrd. It was like appointing Gregory Bateson, this very elderly man who used to fall asleep at the Board of Regents meetings, you know, because he was just very old. And Jerry, I think, got a kick out of that or something. It was almost like, and Dan would know this better than me, but because he was around longer in Sacramento, but, you know, sort of an in-your-face attitude that Jerry had about politics and about governance and that sort of thing. And I think he became much more pragmatic. But, you know, I just want to say something about the death penalty, which brings together both something Dan said about his courage and more caution in his last two terms, and what Annie said about the death penalty. And I think there was a lot of disappointment, including my own personal disappointment in Jerry Brown, that he did not end the death penalty in California, which he was urged to do by former governors who had done it in their own states, in a New York Times editorial op-ed piece, by many, many people. And he said something I thought was very interesting to George Skelton, the LA Times columnist, long time in Sacramento. He said, with the death penalty, George asked him, why didn't you come out? You know, the death penalty abolition was on the ballot twice, and you didn't come out in favor of it. And he said that you have to know when to hold them and when to fold them, citing this poker, I guess, guideline. And I found that was very disappointing, and I thought it showed a lack of courage. And it was unlike, I really expected he was going to do that. He, in this case with Kevin Cooper, who is most likely innocent, who's on death row, he granted a very limited review of his case. That was disappointing. And so, you know, he's very proud of his what he did in criminal justice. He calls it reforming the criminal justice system, and he did do some interesting and good things there, but which Gavin Newsom has now pledged he will continue. But I found the death penalty thing particularly disappointing.
Just in case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the legacy of Jerry Brown with our guests, Narda Zacchino, former associate editor and Sacramento bureau chief at the Los Angeles Times, and author of California Comeback, The Genius of Jerry Brown, Dan Walters, author and former longtime journalist at the Sacramento Bee, now columnist at Cal Matters and the San Francisco Chronicle, and Annie Nottoff, Director of California Advocacy at the National Resources Defense Council. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. What are your thoughts about Jerry Brown's career in California politics as he leaves office? Do you have a favorite Jerry Brown story, and what do you think he'll be remembered for? The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, tweet us, or post a comment on our Facebook page. So I wanted to see if, Dan, you wanted to say something more there about Narda's comments before we start to talk a little bit more about his tenure as Oakland mayor.
Yeah, I think the death penalty thing is a very interesting situation because it goes back into the history, and it also has something to do with his relationship with his father, which was a very complicated relationship. Even though Jerry followed his father into politics, he was kind of rejected his father's political methodology, which was kind of a backslapping, conversational, friendly sort of way of doing things, and there was some tension between the two. There's no question about it. And you might recall the story about Jerry pleading with his father to spare Carol Chessman, from the gas chamber back in the 1960s, and the father, Pat Brown, refusing to do so, and Jerry coming along as governor and then vetoing a death penalty bill as governor. After the Supreme Court had set aside California's death penalty, there was legislation to reinstate it, and he vetoed that legislation but didn't raise a finger to try to overturn sustain the veto, and it was overturned by the legislature in the first time around. So this is a complicated relation. Then he appoints Rose Byrd, who was a very strong opponent of the death penalty, obviously, and she refused to sanction any executions during her time, which cost her her position. And then as Attorney General, he defended California's death penalty in court and did not try to fight it. So, and then finally, in his second incarnation as governor, just wanted to duck the issue entirely. I think he saw it as something that if he took it on, because of his history with that, it would overshadow everything else that he wanted to do in his second governorship, and it would not lead to the kind of legacy that he really wants to leave, even though he said he's not interested in legacy. And so he just decided to let it go and not fight that fight anymore.
You know, it's interesting you bring up Carol Chessman because because one of Jerry's moments where he was really sobered by this issue was and his influence over his father, which actually what Pat Brown did was, I think he stayed the execution temporarily, threw it to the legislature, which was not courageous, and then Carol Chessman ended up being executed. But after that, Jerry talked in one interview I read about going to a San Francisco Giants game where his father was to throw the first pitch of the season, and Pat Brown had been hugely popular, as you recall, and when he walked out on the mound, he was booed. But all the commentators said it was because of his indecision on Carol Chessman. So that stayed with Jerry his whole life.
So
well, certainly something no. that distinguished, that was really different between first and second terms is that his wife and Gus Brown really brought a lot of depth, I think, to his thinking in the second time around. And I think that's one of the things that distinguished the last 8 years is the number of women that were in the administration and that whose counsel he sought. And I think we saw the positive results of that in a lot of his policies on public health and the environment, and also the way he thinks about complex issues. There's a very strong devotion to science and scientific rigor that is, you know, quite a breath of fresh air in today's partisan conversations about climate and other things at the federal level.
So you mentioned, all of you in one way or another, something about his personal life. We haven't talked about the fact that he left the seminary. He was going to become a Catholic priest. He's, you know, socially liberal. He didn't fight against the death penalty. He's often quotes, Jesuit sayings. granted, he's an individual, but how do you put it all together? How do you understand someone who's had this background, this trajectory, and understand the decisions he's made?
You know, Jesuits swear a vow of poverty. And I think when you look at Jerry's, and some of it was for show, for sure, about the driving the Plymouth when he was first governor and eschewing the limousine and the mansion and all this stuff. And but I think a lot of that is really his core. I mean, the fact that after he finished his second term and ran for senator and lost to Pete Wilson, and then he went off to Mexico to learn Spanish, and he went to Japan to study Zen Buddhism, and he went to work with Mother Teresa in Calcutta, and then was ambassador in the 1987 floods. All of that. You don't do that unless you feel it in your, you know, in your bones. You don't go off and do all that stuff. Who would do that? I think that goes to his Jesuit training and his background and why he was interested in the priesthood in the first place.
Mm. And Dan Walters, you keep saying that he's not interested in a legacy, but
he did... what he says. I think he's very interested in legacy. I'm just quoting him.
Yeah, he hates it. He hates the word.
Tell us what you make of his repeated runs for president and senator. Often those runs have been pointed to as flaws in his first two terms as governor, because he was spending more time perhaps campaigning for higher office than actually governing California.
Yeah, I think it's a legitimate thing. You think about it, he ran for governor in 74, he ran for president in 76, he ran for re-election in 78, he ran for president again in 1980, and he ran for the Senate in 82. In other words, his first governorship was one long extended campaign tour. And it's really true. I mean, if you were around the Capitol at the time, he was kind of disengaged. He only occasionally would get involved in issues in the legislature. He had a very difficult legislative relationship. Legislators were older than he was. They remembered his father. They resented him. They thought he was just a snot-nosed kid, basically. And in some ways, he actually was, by the way, a snot-nosed kid. And he had sponsored a ballot measure in 1974 that basically labeled the legislature a bunch of corrupt people. And so he had a very difficult time with the legislature, and he didn't really seem to want to govern California. He really wanted to go out and run for president and make a big name for himself outside of California. And that came through to the voters, which explains probably why he lost that Senate race in 1982. He said the other day when he was speaking to the Sacramento Press Club that he ran for president one too many times. And he certainly did, and the one time he ran for president too many times was 1980. 76, okay, it was a youthful kind of a lark, and no harm, no foul. 1980 was stupid. He had no chance of defeating Jimmy Carter in that year. He got one delegate vote for all his campaign. He got one delegate vote in Wisconsin. It was an embarrassment. He shouldn't have done it. And if he hadn't done it, if he hadn't done that, and if he'd have paid a little more attention to California, he would have won that Senate race in 1982, and he would have been in position to run for president sometime thereafter. But he was so eager and so just full of himself that he couldn't stand to wait his turn, as it were, and run up the ladder. And I think that experience was a sobering one for him. He tried to come back into California politics as state Democratic chairman about 8 years later. That turned out to be a disaster. Then he was going to run for the U.S. Senate in 92, but decided to run for president again in 92 again. And then, as we know, eventually kind of was in the wilderness, came out of retirement, ran for mayor of Oakland, and was on the radio talk show and so forth, and the rest is history. But he could have been a viable candidate for president of the United States if he had just been a little more mature about nurturing his own career.
But don't forget, in 1992, when he ran against Clinton in the Democratic primary, he won seven states, and Clinton was quite worried. And then he made that really big gaffe in New York, saying that he hadn't given up on the idea of asking Jesse Jackson to be to be his vice president, and there went New York, which had been trending in the polls for Jerry. So that was really crazy.
Yeah, it was. But if he had just not run in 80, he could have gotten that Senate seat, and he could have been a really seriously viable candidate for president sometime thereafter.
Yeah. So besides these string of losses for national office, what about his Oakland run as mayor do you think may have impacted the way he approached his second turn at governorship?
I think it made a big difference
because
he became a more pragmatic person dealing with municipal issues at the local level, the potholes and all that stuff, and having to deal up close with people and actually negotiate stuff, which he never really did do before. I think it made him a more pragmatic politician than he otherwise would have been, and probably was necessary as a kind of a form of conditioning, of maturation, as you will, so that he could come back in and have a relatively successful career thereafter in his second incarnation.
Annie, you wanted to say something there?
I was just going to say that he, it was, I think that it did make it harder for him, and it was, I lost my train of thought, sorry.
I could tell you a little funny little story. On the day that he announced for mayor of Oakland, I was there. He signed off of his radio show, came downstairs at his building there at Jack London Square to announce he was running for governor, and he went off on this long tirade against a freeway that he said divided Oakland, and was it was a terrible thing, and blah, blah, blah. And so I asked him, I said, "Well, Jerry, didn't you build that freeway?" He looked at me and he said, "I knew I would not be happy to see you here today."
I know what I was thinking is I think that his work in Oakland did discourage him from taking on the issue of housing at the state level, because he saw how how tough it was at the local level and how it was so divisive between communities. Mm-hmm. And so it was really, you know, he sees that housing, and certainly getting more housing around transit stops so people have an option to get out of their cars, is a hugely important issue that the state needs to help local governments take on. But he was, I think, kind of flummoxed at the Oakland City level as to really how to take that issue on.
Well, he had trouble.
Put that in the category of one of those issues that, like tax reform, that he just did not want to take on because he did not see a high chance of success, and it would have been a failure on his record. And despite his protestations, he's very concerned about his legacy.
Yeah, you know, but I think the biggest thing about Oakland for him is, which isn't mentioned that often, is the two schools he started, which are still operating, the School for the Arts, and these are two public charter schools, and the military school, military academy type school. And he's very proud of both of those things and still raises funds for them and everything. So that meant a lot to him.
So I want to get a caller in here. We have David in San Francisco. David, welcome to the program.
Hi. First, I'll ask if you can hear me okay.
Yes.
Okay, good. I live in SF. And I listened to his radio show during his interval, you know, during his expatriation. But that was a great show, and he was always talking about the schools and education. And it was great fun, and I just would listen to it on my AM radio in my car for an hour. Okay, so I want to add that in his first terms, I think he had a superintendent of education who he could work with, who he also campaigned for. And so there was a little pair of good guys who worked on education, I think. And that's just my opinion. I'm only partially informed, but that's what I recall. Thank you so much. Great show.
All right. Thanks for your call. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about Jerry Brown's legacy as the longest-serving governor of California, with Annie Nothoff of the National Resources Defense Council, Dan Walters, columnist with CalMatters and the San Francisco Chronicle, and Narda Zucchino, author of California Comeback, The Genius of Jerry Brown. 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK is the number you can dial to join our conversation. You can also email us or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, tweet us, or post a comment on our Facebook page. So let's talk now about the second term. So Annie, you obviously have lots of things to say about his record on the environment and on climate change. Why don't you run down for us kind of what you would say his accomplishments there were, where he fell short, and perhaps what's on the docket for Gavin Newsom?
Well, I'd say that first off, I think one of the first bills that Jerry Brown signed when he got into office in 2011 was the state's renewable portfolio standard, which set a standard for 33% clean energy by 2020. Now, by setting that standard, it really helped send a clear market signal that really brought investment into California for clean energy and clean jobs. Now, since then, we've ratcheted that mm-hmm. up to where we are now, with the governor just signed a bill to say we're going to get 100% clean electricity by 2045. But that type of strong market signal has been responsible for some very solid job growth and a reduction of greenhouse gas emissions in California, and it's helped drive that type of clean energy development beyond our borders, because of course one of the things that California can do, because we are as big as we are and our market is as big as it is, we can help by setting strong standards here, we can help change markets elsewhere. So that's a very key thing that he has done, and California has been growing, our economy's been growing while our greenhouse gas emissions have been going down. So we've divorced mm-hmm. emissions from economic prosperity, which is a very important achievement that, you know, is an inspiration around the world. I've had the opportunity to attend several of these international climate conferences, and I can guarantee you that when California walks into the room, people pay attention. Certainly when mm-hmm. Schwarzenegger went to these, you know, he was an international movie star too. But the last one I went to, Brown and Schwarzenegger were there together, and the two of them were really making a lot of news and inspiring people to be more ambitious, I think. So that's a huge accomplishment on its own. I think that there's also, you know, and his willingness to speak up on behalf of science and speak up for California and for good environmental policy in the face of these federal rollbacks from the Trump administration has been helpful, and it's also encouraged other people to speak up mm-hmm. as well. And I think that has, you know, is really responding to what the people of California want. And I think, you know, you can't get elected to a statewide office in California these days unless you do have a strong environmental platform, because that's really what the people of California are expecting. Yeah. You know, you see yeah. poll after poll from, you know, the Public Policy Institute of California or others, there's a real consistent line there that says that people are relying on state government to protect our environment and act on climate. So that's really the foundation of a lot of our elected leaders' actions on this as well. I think there have been some blind spots sometimes on coastal issues or land use regulation. I think that some of that comes from the Oakland experience that we talked about earlier. I think there's been, you know, been criticism that he hasn't tackled the oil industry as forcefully as he should. He certainly talks about having a clear trajectory towards getting away from fossil fuels, but he hasn't regulated them as toughly as some would like to see. He has, I will say that he was, back in 78, he was one of the first mm-hmm. governors around the country that stood up to the federal administration when they tried to drill for oil off the California coast. Right. And so California really started a movement around the country standing up for their coastal dependent economies and their fishermen, fishing industries, and saying that the risk of an oil spill is too great, and we need to protect our coastal economies and our mm-hmm. environment. And a lot of that was our experience with the Santa Barbara oil spill in '68. So,
also, you know, he created the country's first energy efficiency standards when he was governor in his first term, and he appointed Sim Vandaren to the architect who would be the state architect, and he designed the first energy efficient building, office building, in the country. And I think that you know, that California just sued last year, Becerra just sued Attorney General, the Trump administration for failing to published the new energy efficiency standards for home industrial-sized scale appliances and such. And nobody, you know, people don't really think about this, but clean energy, the emission controls on cars forced Detroit to do it for all cars, not just the ones sold in California, because California is the biggest consumer of that. The same thing for appliances. Nobody really thinks about this very much, but your washing machine, your dryers, your dishwashers, they expanded it to computers and printers, everything that plugs in has an energy efficiency standard, which is due to California, and it's around the country because, as I said, California is the biggest consumer of all of these products. So California's had an enormous impact on energy efficiency, if I could only pronounce it, efforts in the country.
Dan
and
Walters?
Not just here in the U.S., actually. China has adopted our fuel efficiency standards. There's states in India that are following a lot of our drought-ish programs. So California plays a larger role than just here at home.
Dan Walters, what do you say about his report card on climate?
Well, it's been one of his hallmarks, and it's probably going to be his preoccupation after retirement. That and
nuclear
disarmament, I think, are going to be his ways of remaining in the public eye. He's got some positions to fill. He's kind of evolved over the last couple of years into, I guess you'd say, the American president for climate change. Because he goes to all these conferences and he's treated like he's a head of state because Trump isn't there. And so I think he really relishes that role and will build on that in his retirement years, when he's not up there on the ranch in Colusa County. But so I think it's something that he could legitimately claim to be have a leadership role. But like all things, there are prices to be paid. I mean, for example, today, as Gavin Newsom was being inaugurated, in his inaugural speech, he mentioned the high cost of utilities that's a burden to California families. Well, those utility costs are very high in California, and one of the reasons for it is the things like the renewable standard. So there is a trade-off on that, and the trade-off in a number of other areas as well. So while there's one thing on one side, there's no free lunch. There's a cost to be paid on the other side, just as there's a cost in gasoline prices to have cleaner gasoline in California and so forth. And the consumers pay those costs, and it's a factor. It's a factor in California's having this extremely high poverty rate, which is based largely on the cost of living in California, housing particularly, but all the other costs make California a very expensive place to live, and it's a price we pay for some of these environmental standards and regulations that we have introduced.
I just want to point out on that, though, we always have to be cognizant of costs, but because California has all these efficiency standards, we're using less energy, and California families' utility bills are lower than most other bills in the country. So the total cost is still lower.
Because you better tell that to Gavin Newsom, because he was talking about it today.
Yeah. But, I mean, it just makes sense if you're not using as much electricity for your lights, your appliances, and that sort of thing. And as someone who drives an all-electric vehicle, a Chevy Bolt, I would say that not having to pay a gasoline bill is a really wonderful thing.
So we have about 6-7 minutes left in the program. I wanted to, because you mentioned Gavin Newsom there, Dan, turn next to where does Gavin Newsom take what Jerry Brown has left him next? So we mentioned earlier high-speed rail and the Delta tunnels. Say a little bit more about that. Let's talk about a little bit more about that. And how do you think Gavin Newsom is going to distinguish himself from Jerry Brown in his first term?
Well, in terms of the tunnels and the bullet train, both of those are unfinished symphonies. Both of those have serious financial issues to be resolved, as well as, in the case of the tunnels, environmental issues. Gavin Newsom's blown hot and cold on both of them. Depending on the time of day, the time of week, what year it is, he's blown for it, against it, in the middle, somewhere, on both of those projects. So it's very difficult to say what he's going to do on either of those. I think Jerry wanted very desperately to have a water deal in place before he left office. He tried very, very hard to get a deal. It's still out there. It still might happen. But he had hoped that he would get the kind of deal that would pave the way for the tunnels to occur. I think he's more interested in the tunnels than I think he is the train, frankly, because I think he sees the tunnels as a form of reconciliation with his father.
Yeah,
It would be the last segment of the state water plan that his father his father's greatest achievement. But what Gavin Newsom's going to do, I don't know. Now, to answer the second part of the question, he clearly will be a more liberal governor when it comes to spending. He's already announced several things that will cost billions of dollars in terms of pre-kindergarten child care and education, family leave. Today he announced that they were going to expand health care to some undocumented immigrants who were not previously covered, and also expand subsidies to upper-middle-class families. He's going to be in a more spending mode. He made a lot of promises to a lot of people on the kind of the left side of the Democratic Party ledger, the Bernie-crats, universal health care and so forth. And now he's got to see whether he's going to actually try to put those things through and raise the money, probably have to raise taxes to make them happen, or somehow wriggle out of the promises that he's made. And I think that's going to be the Gavin Newsom story for at least the foreseeable future, is what is he going to do about all these promises that he's made to get himself elected.
And of course, one of the challenges for Newsom is that, you know, it's one of the reasons that Brown had a hard time, you know, getting to a final water deal, is because he has Trump in the White House, and a lot of these issues require a federal partner. Certainly when it comes to water, the Federal Water Project is one of the hugest players in California. So you've got Trump there, and you don't have anybody to work with.
And
you're actually having to play defense rather than offense. So that's a real challenge for Newsom, I think, going forward on some of these big issues. I think in terms of style, I expect that Newsom's going to have kind of more, get back to kind of more of an inclusive approach, you know, engage people in stakeholder processes, get recommendations about how to move forward. I think that was not Brown's style. He had kind of a close set of advisors, and he also, you know, had a lot of his own ideas on a lot of these things. So I think kind of getting more voices in there is going to be something that we can look forward to in the Newsom administration. And then again, I think on his on the environmental field, I think where he can really make his mark is to really double down on transportation. And if we're going to meet California's ambitious climate goals, we're going to need to get emissions out of the transportation sector. And we're going to have to give and I think you can have a win-win there if you you can deal with housing as well and house more people closer to transit areas. So I think that is a real, you know, big issue that there's a lot of interest in the legislature to work on that on, I think, that he'll take on. I just, one quick note, too, is that with the change in term limits in the legislature, there's a different relationship now, opportunity to work with the legislators who've been there long enough, they know subject matters. That's, they're going to be more partners with the governor than when Jerry Brown came in. He had all this experience, and we had this revolving door of legislators who were speaker for 6 months and then out the door. So I think they're going to have more of a kind of a balance of power in Sacramento.
Narda, I want to ask you, what do you think of Newsom's aspirations for higher office and how that'll impact what he does with his his term as governor?
You know, I think he's not going to jump into anything. He's not going to do. I think Jerry Brown, the lesson learned from Jerry Brown's running for these offices while he was governor, is a one that Newsom will take very seriously. I mean, people, and that's not forgotten what happened to Jerry there. And I think also, I think Newsom does want to be a good governor for California. I thought his speech today was somewhat inspiring. You know, he also, basically his commitment is to families and children. I mean, he talked about, as has been mentioned, the child care for kindergartners, the family leave for babies, he even wants to pay for a second year of community college for free, which will cost about $40 million, I think. Anyway, a lot of money being spent in what he wants to do. But to Annie's point, I mean, he attacked the gun lobby. He attacked pharmaceutical companies for gouging on drugs. He attacked, Trump indirectly. I don't think he mentioned his name, but he did say, he talked about California being a sanctuary for anyone who wants to be here. He talked about, being a guardian of progressive values. He referred to the corruption and incompetence in the White House. So that's not going to get him a lot of support from Trump on anything he wants to do.
So the question is, how is he going to pay for all of this, and how is he going to get the cooperation he needs?
Can I add one thing? I think on his presidential ambitions, in a purely political sense, the best thing that could happen to Gavin Newsom, if he has presidential ambitions, is for Donald Trump to win re-election in 2020 and the seat to open up in 2024. Yeah. If a Democrat takes out Trump in 2020, he's going to be that president, whoever it might be, is going to be around and probably freeze Gavin Newsom out of the picture, unless Dianne Feinstein leaves the Senate and Gavin Newsom decides he wants to replace her in the Senate, which I think is at least a possibility.
He's only 51, right? So if a Democrat won in 2020, he'd be what, like 61 or something? Or
he'd be out of office as well.
Yeah.
I just want to get one caller in here at the end who's be a nice comment on Jerry Brown, the person. Larry from Berkeley, quickly, about 30 seconds for your comment.
My comment is, when history looks back on Jerry Brown, they're going to think how fortunate we were and how blessed in California to have somebody who has such humanistic values, mm-hmm. of such transcendental mental abilities, and somebody who really knew how to get things done, even if he wasn't given credit for. He didn't abolish the death penalty, no, but how many people were executed during his two terms as governor and his term as attorney general? How many?
None, as far as I recall.
Yeah, well, there's the federal...
None. And the reason why there's none is he knew how to work the system. There were plenty of people who wanted to see executions, politicians of all stripes who wanted to take advantage of it, and he knew how to play them.
There's
and
also
played
a federal
them very
ban.
Well on that key issue.
There's a ban right now by the feds on the protocols.
All right. Well, but this point of Larry's, which is the humanistic side,
sure.
the thinker, the scientist, right. or the admirer of science. What do we think of that?
I think it's all true. I think he's. If you can get over your criticisms and the negative aspects to him, I think he's been a terrific governor and has really reestablished people's faith in government, which I think is an important thing to do.
Well, we'll have to stop it there, and perhaps I'll invite you all in a year's time to hear what you think of Gavin Newsom's first year in office. That's City Visions for this evening. My guests were Annie Nottoff, Director of California Advocacy at the Natural Resources Defense Council, Narda Zucchino, former Associate Editor and Sacramento Bureau Chief at the Los Angeles Times, and author of California Comeback, The Genius of Jerry Brown, and Dan Walters, author and former longtime journalist at the Sacramento Bee, now a columnist at Cal Matters and the San Francisco Chronicle. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. And please join my co-host Ethan Elkine next Monday for a discussion of so-called Twitter activism and the rise in consumer-led boycotts. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.